This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are with Richard Rodriguez. It's really the Richard Rodriguez Show, and we're getting to visit. You talk regularly, both in your writing and as you speak, you talk about the children. I think we often forget about our children, and it's particularly weird to me in a country that's so deeply committed to the youthful expectation and metaphor, and the great denials that, as we were speaking...
I think America is enormously sentimental about youth, but in fact, this culture doesn't understand youth at all. I mean, we force our children to grow old very early.
And, grow old, and, not just grow up.
Yes, and to lose their what anybody else would call their innocence pretty early. But there's a cruelty toward youth in this country. I mean, we stamp it out pretty early. And I mean, you see, I speak to a lot of grammar school and high school audiences. You see already the end of childhood quite early, and you know, as early as 9 or 10 years of age.
Why do we do that?
I don't know. I mean, it's partly because I think as middle-aged people, we are so determined not to lose it that we don't give our children the chance to be it. If I go to another wedding in Los Angeles, another Beverly Hills wedding, where the son, who is 12 years old, has to take his mother up the aisle for her fourth marriage, and he seems much older than she does, I'll tell you. It just, the ironies of all of that, and for, you know, the papa, who's three times back, is a record producer, and he really isn't, you know, he pads around the house in gym clothes. You know, you just realize that children... there's no room for children in this culture because the adults are so busy being childish. There's just this enormous incapacity of the middle age to give it up, to say, "You now it's your turn to be young." You know,
you use the word sentimental with respect to children, and I think of sentimental as a not particularly mature emotion.
Yeah.
And what I'm hearing you say as you play that out is this sort of an emotional puerility, childishness that somehow or other we've gotten ourselves into, and I think we know better.
Yeah.
I'm not sure we know better. Do we know better? Well, is anybody pointing this out except you?
Well, to little effect. I on the other hand, I mean, there's something about the childishness of the culture that I rather admire, too. I mean, this is my own ambiguity toward my own culture. Here I am at 6 in the morning, you know, in a new city, going to do what my father at my age would never have done, and that is go to where I'm staying at a hotel. I go to the gym. I go jogging, you know, on a treadmill at 6 in the morning. And I think my father, my Mexican father, would think this is madness. You know, what are you trying to do? Well, I'm trying to keep myself fit at the age of 57. And he would say, well, you know, 57 is 57. It's time to sit down.
I thought it was very interesting in Days of Obligation that you subtitle it An Argument with My Mexican Father.
Yes.
And all the way through, I felt that tension. And again, to take that both micro and macro, isn't that what you're saying about America and, by reflection, the rest of the world, that we are in constant argument about who we are?
We are not a tragic people. That is also why so many people
That's
from so
bad
many
news,
parts,
isn't it?
But it's also the reason why so many people want to come here. It seems to me that we are comic people. We believe in the future more than we believe in any inevitability coming from the past. We therefore allow ourselves to announce our identity through the newcomer. It's the only culture in the world that I know that quite says, you know, the people who are most American are those people who are coming here from elsewhere. I mean, you see immigrants, say, in France, who have to deal with the solidity, the stability of the French idea of itself. Where in America, you know, the outsider is always allowed to be the archetypal American in some sense. That's an extraordinary, extraordinary freedom that this country gives other people. But that said, the argument with my Mexican father that formed the basis of my second book, I'm polishing with my father one summer afternoon our Blue DeSoto. It has wonderful fins that extend all the way to New Jersey from California. It is so long. And I announced to my father that I want to be somebody in this country. I must be about 14, 15 years old. In any American household, you know, most parents would be very happy to have a son saying, I want to amount to something, Papa.
Ambition.
I want to be ambitious. I want to remake myself. I want to go even farther than you went. And he said, life is harder than you think. And I think to myself, what is he talking about? Why didn't I get the praise that I wanted at that moment? And I say to him, not a friendly voice, I say, "You're thinking of Mexico, Papa, where son succeeds father in failure." And he said, and then he says to me, "You'll see." That premonition of tragedy that he announces in Sacramento, California in the 1950s, that in the end my life will turn tragic. Most cultures of the world are formed within that notion of tragedy. Miguel de Unamuno writes a book out of the Spanish sensibility called The Sense of the Tragic. It is very deep in Latin America. It comes to me from Mexico. It is hanging from every bedroom of my childhood house, the crucifix with the bleeding Christ on the cross, that life is summarized not by Easter Sunday in this household, but by Good Friday, that life is always suffering. And it strikes this jarring note in America, where my neighbors never die, they just pass away, you know, where old Mr. Newman down the block didn't die, he passed away yesterday, you know. And I think to myself, I want to become an American, I want to pass away too. Where in Mexico, you know, my aunt, my grandmother in her 80s, still dressed in black, mourning the death of her husband when she was 23 years old. And I think to myself, you know, I want to get away from the solidity of death in cultures of tragedy. I want to be I want to be like the lady next door who had piles of red hair. She looked like Lucille Ball. She drove and my mother didn't drive. She had a divorce. My mother would never imagine a divorce because she was constantly changing her life. You know, she was, and if she got a gray hair, she would dye it tomorrow. You know, I wanted that so much as a son of a Mexican immigrant parents. I wanted the sense of the new. And I think I meet so many young people coming to this country from foreign cultures. And it is what amuses us about America. It's just its childishness and its sense that you do not have to become your father. You do not, your mother was a seamstress. You do not have to be a seamstress in this country. You can become something absolutely new in this society.
You talk at length about not having to be what we think of as authentic, that in fact life is a series of roles. And you talk about tragedy and comedy. You use this theatrical metaphor in a country that hates the theater.
Yes, that is always, I mean, our Puritanism seems to me to go in two directions. On the one hand, it allows for a defiance of the community, which the Puritan tradition was formed by, the sense of independence. But on the other hand, there is this anti-theatrical impulse in America. And now it is wild. It is we are becoming anti-Puritans. Everywhere around me, the young people are engaged in an exploration of color. My UPS man has blue hair. My niece changes the color of her eyes more often than she changes her T-shirts. She is clear. We are playing with color in a country that never had color, in ways that are quite astonishing. I really think that the king of brown right now is Michael Jackson, who morphs himself in a video to look like every face of the world, and the queen of brown is Madonna, who yesterday was Marilyn Monroe and today is Dolores Del Rio, and tomorrow she will be a geisha, and the children of the world are enchanted.
And America's blonde is Tina Turner.
Yes, the blondest American is Tina Turner.
It's a wonderful playground. I want to go back to these categories that we keep trying to fix ourselves in. The U.S. Census Bureau, I think in the last census, finally fessed up that there was a category called other, and generated a good deal of discussion about people, among people. People, some of whom I would have thought would think that other was just fine, and in some ways, brown is an argument for other.
Yes,
as opposed to these categories, and I'd forgotten until you reminded me that these are categories that Richard Nixon brought to
1972,
us. A person that I don't reflexively trust.
Yeah.
But at the time, it seemed like a good idea.
Yeah. At the time, I think Nixon. This is to suspect Nixon. I think Nixon might have been trying to undercut the Negro Civil Rights Movement, which had just moved north, had become the black movement, had moved from Protestant Stoicism to a secular anger. And Nixon may have been intending to undercut that. On the other hand, Nixon was a Californian. He lived less than 100 miles from the Mexican border. there were itinerant Mexican laborers who used to come by in the Quaker household of his mother, and they were brought into the family kitchen and they ate with the family. Nixon was a Californian. He saw the Pacific. This is also the man who walked into China. This is a man who understood in a way that maybe an East Coast politician did not, that we are not a black and white country, that there was color here. And this was at a moment when the NBC Peacock was expanding its wings and the Vietnam War was suddenly turning lime green and we were watching the world in living color. And people were buying refrigerators that were orange, and suddenly Richard Nixon says, we're not only black and white, but we are also yellow and red and brown. And I don't like the category of the other because it tends to make brown into an idea rather than the end of a particular color. I like the idea of telling children to mark yes to everything, to say, I am black, I am white, I am Asian, I am Hispanic, I am American Indian. That seems to me the truer liberation, to make a connection to every living thing rather than to say, no, I am separate from those people who are white. I call myself other. It seems to me that would only institutionalize yet again this identity, which we have to start, I think, melting.
This is Richard Rodriguez. We're going to come back and ask him how it is that he says he is not a race, he is not a color, he is a person. When we return in just a moment, please be with us.